Hey there, it's Mike Tramp, and you're listening to White Line Fever, where rock and roll is still alive like it always has been and it always will be.
Welcome to White Line Fever. This is the start of this week's show. My name's Steve Mascord, but our first guest is a fella who has been on the program the last three episodes, or last two including this. It's Rachel Bolan. Hello, Rachel.
Hello.
Now, reading an interview, reading a recent interview, you said we still get mad about the same things and we still get happy about the same things. I think you're talking about yourself and Snake when you're writing. And also, when you're psyching yourself up to write for a record, you don't listen to anything recorded after 1979. What gets you mad? What gets you and Snake mad? Is it the same thing? What sort of things fire you up when you go in to write a song?
Well, like just on a personal level, things that get me mad is when people try to tell me, "Now you shouldn't do that," and that's a surefire way of me trying 10 times harder to accomplish the goal that people tell me I can't do because I'm doing it the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
I've known Snake since 1986, and I could say 100% that he's absolutely the same way, if not more so. You know, that fires us up, and that's always, you know, we're in our 50s now, and I don't know where all this teenage angst comes from, but it's in there, man. It keeps coming to the surface every time we write, you know. And it just, the feeling of whatever riff we're working with dictates the subject matter sometimes. And that's just kind of how we do it, you know. The same thing that makes everyone else in the world happy makes us happy, you know, just being able to do what you do and have a good time at it. Those are the things that piss us off pretty good.
It sounds like actually that being told by promoters and journalists and people on social media what your lineup should be actually informs your writing in a way that you kind of like feel, you know, you still feel rebels in that way because other people are trying to tell you what you should be doing and who should be in your band. Is that true? Does that actually inform your writing a little bit and maybe give it a little bit of an edge that everyone's telling you what you should be doing?
Well, you know, just in general telling us what we should do, not so much promoters or whatever, but just, like I said, if I want to do something the long way, and someone tells me, no, do it this way, it's much easier, and here's the shortcut. I don't take the shortcut, man. It's like, no, this is the way I'm going to do it. I want to absorb the whole experience. I don't care if it's easier some other way, you know? And that just kind of gives me more determination to accomplish the thing.
All the shows you've got in the books at the moment, you spent a large portion of your life on the road, so how do you sort of not lose it, like as far as like mentally, physically? Do you have a routine? Do you have rules? Do you say, I'm only going to have a beer after the Friday night show every week, or I'm only going to have a beer in the big cities, or I'm going to make sure I'm up early, go for a run, or, you know, do you have these little rules that keep you sane and fit on the road, or is it just, you know, you fix everything when you get home, you know, and just do whatever enters your head when you're on the road and make up for it when you get home? How do you do it?
Well, me personally, I do try to get out more instead of just sitting in a hotel room or laying in my bunk on the bus. You know, I try to get out more these days than I have in the past. But I just kind of try to live my life like I do at home. I don't try as soon as I put regulations on myself, I seem to just cross boundaries. So, you know, if I want to have a beer after the show, if I want to have a beer with lunch before the show, I'm going to do it. You know, I never got into drugs, so that's not even a concern. My whole thing is just it's music and playing is just such a part of my life. If I do it, whatever I do at home, I do the same thing on the road because, you know, it's ridiculous to try and change schedules. The one thing I do try to pay attention to is eating a little healthier because it's so easy just to eat garbage on the road, you know, out of convenience. And I really try hard to eat more healthy on the road.
Okay. And I've got two more questions, Rachel. I'll let you go. One is, you know, you've been talking about you've had offers from record companies. You're looking for a deal, or you're between deals. Any news? Have you got a deal now for this new record?
We are in the works with the deal, and but can't announce it yet. Sorry.
Okay. And maybe this is a crossover. Maybe I'm asking you the same question twice here. But in the most recent interview I could find with you, you said there's another big announcement coming up. Is that about the record, or is there another big announcement coming up? And if so, can you tell us? Can you make it exclusively here, please?
It is about the record.
All right, okay.
The label.
All right, okay. Okay, so hopefully more than one record in the next deal, or are you just going to do it one at a time? Or?
Well, that's what we're working on right now, actually. That's one of the bullet points.
Well, it's nice. Sorry. It's nice to speak to you. I think we're bang on 15 minutes, so thanks very much for your time, Rachel, and I will just get you to give us one more song.
Well, since we're closing it out, we got to close it out with Youth Gone Wild, man.
Welcome back to the program. Our next guest, a guy who's been trying to get onto the show for quite some time. It's Eric Martin from Mr. Big and Avantasia. How are you, Eric?
Ta-da! What do you do when somebody like gives you that big an introduction? You know, hey, we got Eric Martin. Ta-da! Just got out of prison. What's happened?
I'm interested. We're here to talk about Avantasia, and that's why this interview was arranged, because you're off to Australia. You've toured on your own. You've toured with, I think, one other guy. You've toured with a band and a full road crew, and now you're part of this massive production. I just wonder, how do they compare? Like, is it more fun to be on the road? Is more people equal more fun, or would you? How does it compare?
Well, with Mr. Big, I've known the guys for 30 years, right? And in our last couple of tours, we did hang out pretty tight, obviously, because our drummer Pat was going through Parkinson's, and we rallied together big time. But for the most part, of those 30 years, we shined on stage, but we didn't really hang that much on the off days, or when we come off stage, we're pretty quiet. There's no like, woohoo, that was an amazing show, that was so great. We just kind of go, ah, good show, and then we just kind of drift in different directions. And not to say we're not good friends, it was just that's the dynamic that we had. So it was kind of a, and they used to tell me all the time, Eric, you got to calm down. I was definitely like the class clown of Mr. Big for years, trying to put some spark into the guys sometimes. I mean, sweetheart guys, lovely people, but they're private characters, right? But with Aventasia, oh man, it's just, it's like a traveling party. I love all these guys. I'm not the only class clown in the situation. I love hanging out with these guys. They're really interesting. They've all had tastes of success. They don't bring their crazy band baggage to our ensemble. It's just, I like hanging out with these guys. I mean, I know this is, I can't think of any cooler thing to say than it reminds me of Boy Scouts. You know? It just has that camaraderie of a bunch of dudes. You know, hey, call up 14, 15 of your best friends and let's go to the bar tonight. That's how it feels.
That's awesome. That's awesome. We spoke to Bob Catley the other day. Was he a guy you knew before you did this? I obviously knew of him, but did you know him as a person, you know?
No, I as a person?
Yeah.
before he was a wolf? No, I didn't know Bob Catley. I obviously I knew about all these guys, all these singers, but I played this gig, I don't know when it was. It had to be somewhere in the early 2000s, or but it was called the Gods Festival, and it was in England, and it was all these bands for a magazine called Fireworks, Rock and Roll Magazine, and Bob Catley was there playing, and we just kind of hit it off in the hallway before each of us were gonna go on. And just hit it off. I really liked his personality, and I told him I was a fan, and I asked him, hey, would you come out and sing To Be With You with me? And he goes, well, I can't really do an English accent. I even have a brother from Blackheath, outside of London, and he always tells me, that just like any American that tries to speak English or Australian or British or Australian, we sound like Dick Van Dyke.
Well, there's so many accents here. It's not just one accent, is it? So he's got like Brummy accent,
and,
you know?
And everybody's got different ones here because we do have some Brits in the crew, and there's Geordies, there's, I don't know if that's a slang name or if, I'm not trying to be offensive, but got people from Yorkshire and Geordie, got all kinds of accents. Same thing like in America. I don't know what it would be like in Australia, though.
You know, there's small differences, but you've got to listen very carefully. Like for instance, in West Australia, they'll say beer instead of beer and pool. You know, like there's very, very small differences.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there are regional differences, but you have to spend a lot of time there, so.
Well, again, like in America, I mean, like the New York voice is like this. How you doing, Andy? And if you're from Alabama or like that, oh my God, my daddy says I'm the best kisser in the county. I'm going to get in trouble next time I go to Alabama. I got to always start a interview with saying that I am the class clown of the band or the clown prince of rock and roll, and then I can get away with murder. Mm. Anyway, I asked Bob Catley to come out and sing with me, and he was great. He even had a little piece of paper that he was reading, and he has this, like, oh, wonderful to be on. He doesn't have a David Coverdale voice, but he has that kind of, you know, like he lives in a castle.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of posh Birmingham, which is it's not Ozzy Osbourne. It's nothing like Ozzy Osbourne. You finally made it to Australia with Mr. Big. Obviously, maybe bittersweet given the timing, but what were your impressions?
My impressions, well, first of all, it was first for us, you know, coming to Australia, and it was also a perfect match touring with Extreme. We loved it. We loved it. I mean, I had been to Australia maybe 10 years before that, 6 years before that, doing a solo tour that took me around to 10 or 12 cities. And I think with Mr. Big, I mean, it was a long time coming. I don't know why all those times of playing in Southeast Asia that we didn't just take one of those little junks or a little boat across the water and play some shows. It was ridiculous. Never, it was either too expensive or we were on a tight schedule or something, but I don't know why we didn't make the time. I mean, it's not every artist that gets a number one single in a whole country.
Mm-hmm.
And we had it with To Be With You, and we just never took advantage of it. But we finally did show up, and it was great shows. And I mean, I think there was four shows or something like that. I mean, I had been there before, but every time I've been buttering up Your Paradise to Toby, and I call him Toby and the Immortals. That's my pet name for Aventasia. I've been kind of telling him about how exciting and beautiful and, you know, culture and food and all kinds of stuff where, you know, they all can't wait to go, and everybody talks about it, like, every country, so, you know, like, I'm sure there's Australians that, like, want to leave and go see other places in the world, but everybody that you talk to that are in the rock world, you know, your favorite place to play, once they've been to Australia, they say Australia, you know.
Yeah, I moved to London, and suddenly all the good bands started touring Australia, including yourselves, so that kind of sucked. I moved here because I thought there were this is like headquarters for rock and roll, and suddenly everyone went to tour Australia. Can you tell me, can we have a song? We'll have a song, Eric. What song can we play?
When you said that earlier, I thought you meant for me to sing a song right now.
No.
Yeah, that's going to cost you $350. No.
Are you on PayPal?
What song? Can you play an Aventasia song?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, can you play the song Dying for an Angel?
Nobody can
Big and Avantasia, and you're listening to the great music on White Line Fever.
Welcome back to White Line Fever and the second part of our interview with Corey Glover from Living Colour. It's an honour to have him on the program. Thanks a lot for your time. Corey, you were talking about the 2017 album Shade in the first part of the interview, and you said a lot of it is about things that are happening now. As someone who sort of followed Living Colour from the very start, I always thought that, there was obviously a political bent and a lot of social awareness. And in the interviews, we did a lot of interviews back then with Hot Metal magazine in the late 80s, early 90s. A lot of the interviews went overtime because there was a lot of discussion about social issues. Now, And I always thought that there was some sort of hope or of a utopia in the future where a lot of these problems would be resolved. But we never actually got there, did we? We never actually got to...
No.
Where are we now? Where do we get to, do you think?
I think it's a few steps forward and several steps back is where we are right now. You know, we have made some progress. We have made some things a little bit better. But a song like Open Letter to a Landlord still has relevance, you know. On the new record we covered Notorious B.I.G.'s Who Shot You?
Yeah, yeah.
And that the proliferation, at least in North America, of gun violence is ridiculous. We'd think that we'd be a little more enlightened about that kind of stuff. So, you know, we are still trying. What we write about is what we live and what we see in the world, and what we perform is about what we see in the world. And unfortunately, some of it's good. So unfortunately, some of it's good. Unfortunately, a lot of it is bad.
Yeah, yeah. Have you ever had your sort of music used for a political cause that you didn't agree with, or have you got a policy about the use of the music for political causes? And you know, and have you ever felt tempted to, I don't know, to run for office or get involved in that way?
I've never run for office, but, you know, while, you know, here in the States, the last couple of months have been an election season, and you hear cult of personality a lot. And there was there have been discussions in certain news cycles about the word cult of the phrase cult of personality, and of course the song gets played with it. And otherwise, you know, in terms of campaigns, we've been asked in the past to use some of our songs for certain things, and depending on, you know, we basically have refused up until now. So we'll see what happens.
Is there a cause that you would get behind?
Yeah, I'm sure there is one I can think of right now. Hell no. but you know, Time's Up, for example, is a song about, you know, the environment. It's really about the environment. And the idea when we wrote it was like, the time is now to change things. And what we're finding out now from climate scientists is that time is up.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no turning back now. There's nothing we can really do about it other than mitigate whatever problems come up. So it's funny that the song that's 25 years old is still relevant now.
Tell me, who was when Cult of Personality first sort of bubbled to the surface? Was there a face or a group of faces in the minds of the band when they created the song? Was there a certain person who inspired, or was there a certain type of person?
It was the idea of a political personality that. Back then, who knows what it could have been. It was, you know, Ronald Reagan, probably. And that he had, you know, there was not just a cult of personality, but they cultivated who he was and what he represented. They did the same thing with John F. Kennedy. Unfortunately, they did it during and posthumously. You know, but there was this idea that in order to that a political ideology is a commodity that you have to sell.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
what
yeah.
Talking about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Rather than the actual issues, it's all about It's all about just engaging people with personalities. Why don't we have another song, Corey, and we'll come back with the final bit of the interview. For the listeners, that'll be in the next episode.
Cool. Let's play Time's Up. Talk about that.
Welcome back to the program. I am at a memorabilia fair at St Helens in the bowels of the Totally Wicked Stadium, and Maskell Browns is operating, and there's a lot of amazing memorabilia around here. And I have a very special guest a rugby league guest on this program. It's Trevor Delaney, the man who found the World Cup.
Identified it. I didn't actually find it, but I was the man who really identified it when it went into the press. Another gentleman actually found it, but he hadn't a clue what it was at the time. And took it to the police, and it went through the usual process. And I was fortunate that, being a rugby league historian, I immediately identified it when it was in the press at the time. I like to think it was saved in a way, because he was going to give it to a mate of his who ran a bodybuilding spa sort of thing, and he told me that it was going to be more or less melted down and used as their annual award. So in that sense, it's fantastic nowadays to see it going all around the world, places like Papua New Guinea, Singapore, to see Nigeria involved in it, and it's great that we've got this iconic trophy back on board, and making the full use of it in connection with the 2021 World Cup.
What state was it in when you first saw it?
Well, at the time, they were using it to put the kids' toys in. And the lid was damaged, as I remember it. Of course, the The Cockerel was missing, which I think has been replaced lately. And it was looked a bit dented. So I'm amazed now to see that it's been fully renovated and looking absolutely sparkling brand new. So, you know, it wasn't in very good condition when I did see it, but it obviously was the trophy that went missing 20 years previous.
Can you just talk us through your thinking when you first laid eyes on it? What were the circumstances, and when did that sort of light bulb appear above your head that's what it was?
Well, I knew straight away it was, because it's a unique shape.
It was in someone's lounge room, or where was it?
It was in the press. This gentleman who'd found it, he'd been trying to find out who the owner was for something like 2 or 3 months. He'd been to various rugby union clubs and I'd tried to get it on the television to publicise it, and they said it was not a story, a non-story. He took it to the police, and after the statutory 30 days or whatever, he got the trophy back. So that he had one final attempt, obviously, to find out what it was, and it was in my local paper. So when I opened the paper on that particular day, it just jumped out at me, you know, that I knew straight away. So I got straight on to the rugby league and the newspapers, and I think I spoke with David Howes, who was the PRO at the time, but he was in a important management meeting. So he asked me to go up to see this gentleman who lived just up the road, which I did, and I convinced him that it was the trophy. But it took some while to get it back. I think this gentleman, I don't think he was totally convinced that the rugby league owned it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it took about a week until the rugby league finally negotiated with him. He didn't want anything as a reward. I think he's since had tickets to one of the World Cup games. And I think it was Roger Millwood who finally handed it over.
Mm-hmm.
He handed it over to Roger Millwood maybe a week afterwards, you know.
Now, can you tell? You said you're a rugby league historian. Can you tell us a little bit about what that entails and how you sort of became involved in the game and what your life is away from rugby league? Just tell us a bit about yourself.
I have a life apart from rugby league. Well, I've been watching the game, of course, since the 50s. So I started writing about it when I did the Grounds of Rugby League in 1990-ish.
I think there's about to be an auction here, so we better pause, Trevor. But okay, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Steve. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Nice to
meet you. Cheers.
name is Jesper. I'm from DAP. I am beside Steve Masmer. We are naked. And this is White Line Fever.
Okay, welcome back to the program. Very special guest here, Bob Catley from Magnum and, of course, Avantasia. That's why we're speaking to him, because they're off to Australia soon. Welcome, Bob.
Yeah, how you doing, everybody? Good day.
Now, Australia hasn't been one of the kind of prominent territories over the years for Magnum, has it? Have you spent much time there?
Well, Magnum would love to play in Australia, but I think we have to start selling a few more albums in Australia before some promoter says, oh, come on over, there's an audience for you. I mean, I know that we have Magnum fans who love what we do in Australia, but I think we need to, have some chart positions or something in Australia before anybody will ask us over there. But it's a lovely thought. we play around Europe mainly, which is our main territories, Germany and Sweden and the UK. But yes, I mean, that's why I'm looking forward to coming over soon with Avantasia, because I've never been there. And we're playing in Sydney and Melbourne, as you probably know. And it's going to be great, and it'll be a great experience for me personally. So I'm really looking forward to it, and I can't wait to get there. Great.
So what can the fans in Sydney and Melbourne expect from you personally? How long are you on stage during the Avantasia show?
Okay. Yes. I'm involved in five songs. The first two, you come on and do two, and then other people come on and do their part songs with Tobias. Tobias is involved in all of them. So it's like duos, like an opera, only heavy metal rock. Mm. And I get to sing Lavender, which is on the new album Moonglow, which was written by Toby for me, especially to sing on that record. And then I sing a song that started me off with Avantasia all those years ago, a song called The Story Ain't Over, which is a big crowd pleaser. Everybody knows it and loves the song. And then other people come on and do their songs the same, and then I come back on and I do another two songs, but like duos, and with singing with somebody else. And then we have an encore situation. Hopefully we get an encore. And then everybody comes back on for that one. And you take a couple of lines each in that song and then join in on the chorus. So it's good fun. And I love singing with Avantasia. It keeps me going after all these years. And it's so nice to be invited, you know, time after time. Tobias keeps asking me back, so he must like what I do for him, and I do get a lot of pleasure out of doing it. Thank you.
Yeah, is it vocally a different... Well, firstly, the first question I was going to ask was, you're referred to in the publicity as a cast member. Is it like playing a role? Do you have to kind of put yourself into a different headspace, or from your perspective, is it just singing?
Well, yeah, I mean, so on the albums, you're a different character each album you appear on. It's an ongoing story through all these albums, so I'm told by Tobias. But the characters keep changing throughout the story. But on the stage, you're there just to raise your voice and sing like you've been invited to, and forget being a character. You're not doing the album on the stage. Just highlights from. It's a great gig, like I do with Magnum all the time. But then I'm just on the main singer, and I'm there for hour 45. But here you can really go for it. You pack all your energy and all the high notes, you pack them all into those two songs that you're on for, and then the other two songs when you come back after your break. So you can really go for it. You don't have to pace yourself like you would on a long Magnum tour, you know?
Yeah.
Because I'd probably be worn out after the first night if I did that. That'd be crazy, and I'd lose my voice. But you're allowed to really show off and go for it and, you know, shine, as I like to say. And we're all the same, and we all get such tremendous pleasure from it. And the audience as well, I mean, the audience get really involved. We try to keep them in cheering us all the way through the show. It's they're another member of Fabantasia, the audience are. And the atmosphere is terrific, as you will see when we eventually play in Sydney. Okay.
Yeah, before we introduce the first song, I just wondered, like, obviously these days it's hard with record sales and you only get a fraction of a cent for streams, but there are new opportunities for musicians, aren't there, like Avantasia. Are there a number of things, Bob, that you get involved in and I guess earn a living from that weren't around 20 years ago? Avantasia would be one of them. What are some of the other things, that the other opportunities, you know?
Yes. Yeah, well, a couple of years ago, myself and Tony Clarkin, who the guitarist who writes the songs, we were invited on something called Rock Meets Classic, which was we were allowed to do four Magnum songs, but in front of an orchestra.
Mm.
It was a classical rock tour with an orchestra from the Czech Republic, all young people, younger than us anyway. And they, that wouldn't be hard, would it? And it was fantastic to perform like that. We've done quartet stuff before for a B-side many years ago, but this was like half of most of an orchestra, and it was fantastic to hear the songs treated in that way. I've seen other bands perform with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, Deep Purple have done it, and other bands, Marillion, I think. And this was fantastic to do it, and I'll never forget that. I've been involved with other projects over the years, but I just stick to Magnum and Avantasia these days, and I think that's only fair to the songwriters within those bands, to Tony Clarkin in Magnum and to Tobias Sammet in Avantasia. If I put myself out, you know, to the highest bidder all the time, I think it would look rather cheap and nasty, and I don't want to become that person. So I try to be very loyal and to Tony and to Tobias, and I think that they know that, and they're happy. Tony Clarkin is happy for me to sing for Tobias on Avantasia albums and tour it whenever that comes across. And Tobias is more than happy for me to be the singer with Magnum, because that's why I'm there in the first place, because he's such a big Magnum fan.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think he would appreciate me doing like direct competition. There are other projects out there quite similar to Avantasia, and I have been asked to appear on them, but I said no, I've got enough to do, and it wouldn't be right, it wouldn't be honourable to keep doing that. So I stick to what I've got, which is Magnum and Avantasia, and that's more than enough for me, I tell you. It's enough, and I can put my heart and soul into both of those bands, and that's how it should be.
TSO is one that comes to mind. Have you got a song for us? First song.
I'd love you to play Lavender, which is on the new Avantasia album, Moonglow album.
They would take him small pains to not make him realize, made him feel he's different through and through. A monster in his own way, communicates in quarantine, unleashed down the world without a clue. Surrounded by the ghosts of failing pictures, they come and slip away. Yeah. Vivid memories roll and spin. What's up?
pay what the fathers cast my way. I wink it up to bow, times of change.
Welcome back to White Line Fever, and for the second episode in a row, I'm here with Tom from Classic 78. Welcome back, Tom.
Thank you, Steve. It's good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. Now, I thought this interview is in three parts, and I thought this part I'll talk about some practical stuff, and then the third part I'll talk about some broad brush, almost sort of, I don't know, we'll wait till the third part before we get that. But from a practical point of view, the song you played on the last episode was Jendel. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if Gene would have advised Ace to copyright the name of the planet, Jendel. I guess part of the, you know, you've got to tiptoe around legal issues, particularly with a band as big as Kiss. Have there been any legal issues yet? Have you got professional advice about what you can and can't do? You obviously can't wear the makeup. Or have you just kind of just been stumbling along and hoping you don't get in trouble?
That's a good question. There's actually, you know, initially I thought about that when we were first putting it together because I didn't know it was kind of uncharted territory for us. So, but basically, you know, we're not stealing anybody's, trademarked, identity or images. Mm. And, you know, the sound of the band is intentionally, you know, trying to sound like something like early Kiss. But, you know, if we were actually stealing lyrics or stealing actual melody lines or actual guitar riffs and saying it was us when it's really them, or if we were doing what we were doing and saying it's Kiss, yeah, then now you're getting into some legalities. But, you know, we stayed clear from that, even to the point of having the same kind of font with the name. You know, we didn't want to even, could the music sound so much like those early Kiss records that we didn't want to take away from that by being, like you said, cheeky and start using lightning bolt S's and stuff from the classic and stuff. Because it's totally a tribute to those guys and the sound that they created in those albums that mean so much to us. There's nothing sinister about it at all. And, you know, fortunately for us, the feedback that we've gotten, you know, not only from the fan base, but from Paul and from Gene, you know, that's been communicated to us has been nothing but positive. And, you know, they seem to be pretty wowed by it. And in Paul's words, it's like he enjoyed it even just for the novelty of it, because the novelty of it is it's a Kiss album without actually being a Kiss album.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah. Kiss stopped touring. Is that good for you or bad for you?
It doesn't really affect anything, because we're not touring, or we're not trying to find a place in the marketplace where, oh, they're not doing it, so let's go out and start touring, or we better stay off the road because they're going to tour. Everything we've done has been about the music and letting people experience the music themselves. So, you know, in simple terms, if you're listening to one of the songs, Let Me Rock and Roll You, from the first, you know, from the first classic 78 album, you know, I don't want you to think about me singing that song. I want you to be thinking about those early images of Kiss that used to blow your mind when you were listening to Kiss records, staring at those album covers, you know. It's not important that you think of Tom from classic 78. We want you to connect with those old, those feelings that you had when you discovered that music. This is just an extension of that. That's been created in a unique and fun way, totally as a tribute without any hoaxing going on. It's we're classic 78. These are songs that we've written, but we're intentionally, you know, attributing, you know, those early Kiss days.
So there's no future for classic 78 as a live band?
I don't think so. I mean, only because there's a lot of people who don't want to know who we are. You know, that's why, you know, like I my last name, but you know, the reason why I don't mention my last name when we do interviews or when any of us do interviews is just because most people don't want to know. They like to have the image that they have in their own mind about what's going on. So we don't want to blow that mystique for them, because again, mystique is something that Kiss had in bucketfuls back in the 70s, and that mystique is gone because you know, everybody knows who these guys are and what they look like. So that's a little bit of a ingredient that we can add to our music just by not revealing my last name or revealing our identities. And, you know, touring is something that's tough for actual acts who are out there doing it, who have, you know, 20, 30, 40 year careers. And I don't think it would be something that would be beneficial for us or for the fan base at this point. But if the Kiss Cruise called us, or if there was a significant event or a festival, we would do it in a heartbeat because we're all capable. But those opportunities haven't shown themselves, and we've expressed interest, but you know, it's not something that has become a reality. And it's important that we hit the target if we were to do something like that.
Yeah, I think with the Kiss Cruise, soon Kiss won't be on their own cruise, so you know, there's going to be a spot in the schedule there for other bands and for members, you know, playing solo and maybe bands like yourself. It'll become like a kind of a tribute festival, won't it? The Kiss Cruise. So there might be an opportunity there.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah. Can we have another song?
Yeah, I would say let's do Passion and Love from side one.
Forever. Doing
Classic 78, and you're listening to White Line Fever.
Welcome back, and our guest is someone would have liked to have had on the podcast years ago. Danko Jones, how are you, Danko?
Hi, how's it going, Steve?
Good, good. Now, you've been a bit ill. We were just talking off air about it. You were just about to go on tour, most notably to Australia. Will you be okay?
Will I be okay?
Yeah, you've been a bit ill today.
I should be fine.
You should be fine. Now, it's first time in Oz for a while. Tell me, when you and you're playing 4 gigs in 4 days, again, exhaustion, you know. What was it like last time? And when you go on tour, do you kind of do the rock gig thing? Do you go to Bon Scott's grave and do all that sort of stuff? Or do you just try kind of, as you say, try to look after yourself?
I don't really get sick very often. I got sick today because I just mentioned it online because I had originally said I was going to attend a rally to protest our premier here in Ontario and his cuts to Toronto public health. So that's the only reason why I actually broadcast that. We visited Bon Scott's grave the last time we were in Australia in 2013. I usually don't do any tourist things. I usually concentrate on the show that I have to play.
Right. I first saw you guys way back in 2001. I don't know whether you, I think it was in Manchester with Backyard Babies. Now, I don't know whether you prefer to talk to a journalist who you speak to with every release and every tour, so all the questions are new, or whether you don't mind hearing from someone who's watched from afar for a while, but I just wondered your expectations way back then of being in this band and what lied ahead compared to the reality. How big a difference? Has it been different to you anticipated, or has it played itself out much as you expected?
From when I was a kid, or
yeah, from when the band started. You know, when you first started touring overseas and doing that sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, when we started the band, we just wanted to play America, see if we can go down there and tour with our favorite bands, and that was really all that we wanted to do. We never even thought about going farther out than North America. So when the opportunity arose to go to Europe and then and then go to other continents, it was definitely beyond our expectations when we originally started the band, for sure.
Yeah, and just, I guess, with, the way rock music has evolved since then, I've seen you talking a little bit about that in interviews, and you said that you're kind of comfortable now that rock is underground. So, you know, do you feel that the band has kind of realised its potential given the climate of that period, of the last sort of 18, 19 years?
No, because I've seen other rock bands kind of exceed us and go past us. You know, bands like Volbeat and Airborne, they've done way better than we have. So they've set the ceiling that we still have to go and try and reach.
And what's it going to take to reach that, Danko? What do you need to do? What's the missing piece?
Well, you know, the music industry isn't not set in its ways. There's a lot of variables. You can come out with a really great record, but all it takes is someone to ignore you, and no one will ever hear it. And that's why a lot of bands are out there that no one knows who could probably fill stadiums, but no one will ever know them because they never got a proper release. So it's hard for me to answer the question. I don't know. Only thing we can do on our end is make good music, music that we can stand behind and hopefully people will like. And I think we've been pretty consistent doing that. Now, once we've made the record and put it out there, it's really in someone else's hands.
Yeah, right. Let's have a song, Danko. What can we play? Something from the new album or whatever you want?
Yeah, how about the first single, Dance, Dance, Dance?
when she moving her feet. If you turn it up a little bit higher, gonna lose it and I'll start to perspire. I don't mind cause I'm along for the ride. I don't mind cause I'm along for the ride. I like to see her moving up and alive. I get off watching her gets me high. I don't mind cause I'm along for the ride. I don't mind cause I'm along for the ride. I like to watch her move her hips to the side. Watching her gets me high.
I got a white line fever. Going around land down under. Going to turn around the corner way down yonder. But I'm not even going to try to rhyme anymore. Michael Monroe here for White Line Fever. And you get a chance, come and check us out live. We're going to rock your socks off and whatever. Rock like fuck. That's what I say, okay? Come on down and rock on.